I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday afternoon. The New York Times Sunday Magazine section, I'm sure many of you have seen it this past Sunday, is unique. It is an entire issue narrative, a short book on the catastrophe that's fractured the Arab world since the invasion of Iraq 13 years ago, leading to the rise of ISIS and the global refugee crisis. It is titled Fractured Lands. More than a decade of war, terror, and revolution has left a trail of ruin in the Arab world. This is the story of how a region came apart, seen through the eyes of six people whose lives were changed forever. The story is told through characters in Egypt, Libya, Syria, Iraq, and Kurdistan. And we are speaking with the writer of this extraordinary piece of journalism. Scott Anderson is with us, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, author of Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. Scott was raised in East Asia and attended the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He has been a war correspondent for 33 years, covering conflicts in Chechnya, Egypt, Israel, Lebanon, Northern Ireland, and Sudan. And he, in the early 70s, traveled through this region as a young boy with his father, a journey, he says, that sparked both his fascination with Islam and his love of the desert. The Middle East was also the site of his first foray into journalism. He went to Beirut in 1983, hoping to find work as a stringer. And so we talk about this. It's a complicated story, but such an important story and very, very well told in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, kind of a must-read piece of journalism. Our phone number for you to join the conversation with Scott is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that is @KDunnShow. Scott, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and congratulations. It's such a well done and important piece of journalism.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, very, very important. You have spent a lot of time in the Middle East. At one point in the article, you say that you have found no other region, and you've been through many of them, to rival the Arab world in its utter stagnation. Why don't we start with the stagnation and what you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean the political stagnation.
Mm-hmm.
You really can't find another area of the world up until the Arab Spring revolutions, and it started in 2011, where you had these oligarchies and dictatorships that had been in power for 30, 40 years, and virtually no political expression, political movement at all throughout the region. And that's what initially made me and you know, maybe other observers of the region somewhat optimistic when the Arab Spring revolutions started in 2011, that it finally there seemed to be some sort of political movement that would herald positive change.
And a movement that would look at the country itself rather than external forces, although external forces can be blamed for many of the problems, but really self-examination.
That's right. I make the comment also in the article that the one thing I've always felt is a feature of Arab culture is this this kind of a culture of grievance, of looking to the outside world to blame for the problems, or to look to the outside world as the focus of their anger, you know, whether it's anti-imperialism, anti-West, anti-Zionism. And, of course, the dictators were very, very adroit at using, at channeling that popular anger towards external enemies, blaming the problems of their society on some external force. And again, that's what seemed to be so optimistic initially with the Arab Spring revolutions, was that for the first time the people's anger was directed where it probably always belonged, which was at the leaders and the dictators themselves.
Mm-hmm. And you were, as so many people were, seeing the news of the Arab Spring and feeling a lot of people were fairly hopeful.
Yes, I was definitely among those. When the first sort of riot started in Tunisia, and very quickly led to the overthrow of the strongman who'd been there for 23 years, and then spread to Egypt very quickly after, leading to Hosni Mubarak's overthrow, and then spread to Libya and on to Syria. And it really did seem for a while that there was a great deal of hope, and that, you know, it seemed, again, somewhat naively in hindsight, but it seemed almost inevitable that this would lead in a lot of these countries to some sort of representative democracy in these countries.
You tell the stories through six pretty extraordinary individuals, and we probably won't have time to get to all of their stories, but let's start with the Iraqi story because it's crucial to the whole story of the Arab world at this time, and I'm not sure how to pronounce her name. And you say in the epilogue that you were really taken by her story, the power of the individual to bring change. No person you met more exemplified this than Khaled al-Zaidi.
Yeah, you pronounced it very well.
Oh, good.
No, Khaled was an amazing woman. She was 23 years old when the Americans invaded Iraq in 2003. She was just finishing college, and she was from a very traditional Shia family in a provincial city in southern Iraq, with a very limited future as a result of being a woman in that kind of culture. When the Americans came in, she was rather entranced by the notion that this was going to be a new democratic regime in Iraq, one in which women would have full rights. And so she started working very almost immediately with the coalition provisional authority, the United States installed government, working on women's rights issues, and set up her own NGO working for women's rights. And then as the American presence started to recede in Iraq and started getting attacked, she continued to try to work on these projects and ultimately ended up being death-threatened by the militias in Iraq. She ended up finally having to flee for her life and spent 11 or 12 years in exile in Jordan, and managed to get some of her family out. She got her father and two of her sisters out. And then just recently, about 6 months ago, after this limbo existence in Jordan, finally joined the exodus to Europe. She got on a boat in Turkey and crossed to Greece, and she and one of her sisters are now are refugees in Austria. But just an amazing story of how this woman, who, you know, she's the youngest daughter in a family of six. So, you know, within the power structure of a typical Arab family, this is not someone who should you would peg as a leader. But she really single-handedly, and just through the force of her personality, has managed to save a lot of her family.
Hmm. What was the impact? This is a big question, but you've been there, and a big part of the article looks at that. The impact of the 2003 American invasion of Iraq.
Yeah, I think what the invasion did, it just scrambled the entire chessboard of the region, not just of Iraq, but really of the entire Arab world, and not necessarily for ill. As I mentioned, this had been such a politically stagnant part of the world, and so one could make the argument that some sort of change, some sort of rupture was needed. I think the problem was the Americans really had no idea or no plan of how they were going to harness what they were creating by overthrowing Saddam Hussein. Very quickly, the country devolved into civil war and sectarian civil war. And I think on a larger level, by overthrowing Saddam Hussein, it also, you know, he'd been in power for 30-some-odd years. And so it sent a message. It had a destabilizing influence throughout the region, and also had this effect of stoking sectarian tensions in countries when war started in Syria, it led to this kind of the possible in the Arab world, and unfortunately the possible has tended to be pretty catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. There were also so many indications, as you write about, that all the guns that people got, they got into the wrong hands, and they were available, and there wasn't much of a plan of what to do with people from one regime who were employed, who suddenly became unemployed. What happened to the people who used to be with the army and who got a hold of weapons?
Right.
I mean, it was just chaos, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The Pentagon had come up with you know, very, very exhaustive blueprints of which ministry to take hold of, which, you know, which leaders around Saddam Hussein they wanted to arrest. But apparently gave no thought to the fact that Saddam Hussein had left arsenals and arms depots throughout Iraq, and Time and again, these were raided. In the very first days of the American invasion, these were raided by local people and by local gangs, carting off heavy weaponry. And the second aspect to this was that what they called the de-bathification policy, the Ba'ath Party of Iraq, which had ruled with Saddam Hussein, all the senior leadership was summarily dismissed from their positions. And the way the government and the military worked in Iraq, as it does throughout most of the Arab world, is that every ministry is it's a little monument of nepotism. So it's, if you fire the guy at the top, in fact, you're disenfranchising. You're ultimately firing all the people down below him. So it had the effect within about 6 weeks of Americans taking Iraq that everybody who had some small stake in the status quo in the pre-existing system were now disenfranchised and armed. So it was a recipe for disaster.
Mm. You start this. It obviously must have been a very moving story for you with the story of Dr. Azar Merkan, who is driving into northern Iraq as you start the story. He changes his clothes into the traditional dress of a Kurdish Peshmerga warrior. He's got with him a combat knife, a semi-automatic assault rifle with extra clips in the front, and he's going to northern Iraq for what reason?
To fight ISIS. Azar Merkan is a doctor, a Kurdish doctor, who's now taken a semi-permanent leave from the hospital where he works in the Kurdish capital to devote all his energies to fighting ISIS.
Mm.
And the thing that really haunts Azar, as the way I start the piece, is that he saw when ISIS launched its offensive into northern Iraq in the summer of 2014, he knew that, or he sensed that ISIS was going to be coming for the Kurds next, and he knew exactly where the ISIS was going to attack, and he couldn't get anybody in the Kurdish leadership to pay any attention, and so he almost single-handedly tried to race to this town where he knew ISIS was coming, Sinjar, and he got there a day too late. And the previous day, ISIS had attacked Sinjar. They ended up murdering about 5,000 people, taking thousands of women as sex slaves. And just creating a humanitarian catastrophe there, and this disaster that he had seen coming and had been failed to avert really haunted Azar. I ended up going back with Azar when this town of Sinjar was liberated from ISIS, and spent a day going through the ruins of the town with him, and it was just a very moving experience.
So he's given up his practice to do this full time.
Yeah, he is from a. You mentioned Peshmerga. It's a kind of the warrior caste of the Kurdish culture. His father had been a Peshmerga general back in the 1970s. Azar, along with being a doctor, had undergone Peshmerga training. And so it's a very odd thing. He is a doctor, but he is also just a, kind of a natural hunter. And this, in his mind, is the most important thing he can do right now, is fight ISIS.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the fight against ISIS in northern Iraq. Is progress being made, Scott?
It is. When I was there, I was out on the front lines. It was a little creepy at times. I was about a half kilometer away from ISIS-held villages. And you could see the black and white flags flying, which is kind of sends a chill up your spine.
I imagine.
But yes, it does seem to be. And it now, almost every day, in fact, just today I saw that another series of ISIS-held villages had been captured by the coalition forces in northern Iraq. So it does seem progress is being made, at least in Iraq, probably less so in Syria.
Mm-hmm. We've always wondered, we spend a lot of time thinking about how in the world could somebody go into ISIS. You also highlight one of your six characters as a young man who joins ISIS.
Right, Waqaz Hassan. Waqaz is from a small town. He's Sunni, as virtually all ISIS members are. He was actually from a village just outside of Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit. 21 years old when ISIS took his village. He was a kid with really no real future, no economic future, kind of scraping by, getting pickup day labor jobs on construction sites. And when ISIS came in, he and his older brother joined up. And as part of Waqaz's basic training, if you will, he was made to execute six ISIS prisoners on six men on six different occasions. This was just the way that ISIS hardens their volunteers. He ended up serving with ISIS as a soldier for a year. After a year, and the odd thing, you know, you think of ISIS as such a terrorist organization, but there's quite a bureaucracy to ISIS. He actually signed a year's tour service. At the end of the year, he left ISIS. He tried to slip back into a Kurdish city and maintain anonymity. He was captured by the Kurdish authorities. And when I interviewed him, I had two long interviews with him in a secret prison camp outside of the Kurdish city of Kirkuk. At that point, he had been in prison for about 3 months, and actually has a very grim future ahead of him. They're basically keeping him alive to when they retake towns where he served with ISIS, so that he can identify his old comrades. And once his usefulness comes to an end, he's going to be handed over to the Iraqi authorities, who will almost certainly execute him.
Mm. Well, you chillingly talk about his executing people. He didn't even know what his job was going to be, but some of his first jobs were to shoot people in the head.
That's right. Yeah, in fact, it was one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen. He actually acted out exactly how he'd do it and pointed out with a guard that he was using as just a model. Well, you shoot in the back of the head, but you don't shoot directly in the center. You go off a little bit to the side. I'm just very cold and analytic about it.
Hmm. I guess the one that most people thought, and it was covered as this joyous thing that was going to happen in Egypt, where we were going to have true democracy. You also highlight a very interesting family and a woman, particularly from Egypt, and how things rapidly, democracy, and then a short time later, the military takes over. The spring didn't last very long there at all, did it?
No, it didn't. It lasted about 2 years, The subject, the Egyptian subject I focus on, her name is Leila Swaif, and she's a mathematics professor at Cairo University, and she and her husband were probably the best known political dissident couple against the Anwar Sadat regime and then against Hosni Mubarak. And so she was really in the front lines of the Tahrir Square demonstrations that led to Mubarak's overthrow. And very quickly she saw that she told me that she went to the political parties and said, even before Mubarak was overthrown, and said, you have to seize power. You have to just grab the reins of government. You can't let the military step in and co-opt the revolution. And the political parties just kind of didn't listen to her and to a few other independents who were advocating this. So the military stepped in. They had a kind of an interim government for about a year, and then they had, in 2012, had the first democratic elections in the history of Egypt. And the man who won was Mohamed Morsi, who was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, so a kind of a moderate Islamist. And then very quickly what happened, what you saw, and for me personally, this was really when I saw how the Arab Spring revolutions were really going south. Within a year of Morsi taking power, he did a lot of stupid things. He became very unpopular. And within a year of his presidency, some of the same young, urban, educated protesters who had overthrown Mubarak, who had taken to Tahrir Square, were now calling for the military to step in to overthrow Morsi. So, whether you agree with the president or not, he has been democratically elected, and now you're turning back to the military and asking for his overthrow. And the military was more than willing to oblige. And so now you have a new military regime under Sisi, General Sisi in Egypt, that's far more repressive than ever existed under Sadat or Mubarak. And in fact, two of Leila Swaif's three children are now in prison for protesting against the Sisi government.
Oh, so many people must have had some of the same sense of joy in many of these countries some years ago. You must have encountered people who are just completely demoralized.
Yes. Yeah, I think kind of across the region, I would say that's the prevailing sentiment I see. Certainly in Egypt, Egypt is such a sad, grim place now. It's so much more repressive than it's probably it's ever been in modern history. Economically, it's ruined. There are terrorist attacks in Egypt enough that it has gutted the tourism industry, which is a kind of a pillar of the economy. And certainly, you know, Syria, Libya, Iraq, yes, I think the overall sentiment is just one of complete demoralization at this point.
Scott Anderson is our guest this hour. The New York Times Magazine, I hope you've had a chance to see it, devoted the entire issue last Sunday to Scott's story, along with photos. A photographer was with him on this journey. Scott, in 2015, although he's been in the region and has written a book about the region, he and the photographer, Paolo Pellegrin, went on a series of extended trips to the Middle East to gain greater understanding of the Arab Spring and the aftermath of the Arab Spring. And then it all developed into a number of people, tens of thousands of people, having to leave their countries. So it also looks at travels to the islands in Greece, who have, as he writes, bared the brunt of the migrant exodus from Iraq and Syria to the front lines in northern Iraq, where the battle against ISIS was being waged most vigorously. So they've also looked at the huge refugee problem. We're welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The piece in the August 14 Sunday New York Times, it's the whole issue. Fractured lands, more than a decade of war, terror, and revolution has left a trail of ruin to the Arab world. This is the story of how a region came apart, seen through the eyes of six people whose lives were changed forever. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Scott Anderson. We start with Helen in Madison. Hi, Helen.
Oh, hi. Yeah.
Hi.
Mr. Anderson, it is amazing. I would like to ask you just to expand on two of the things that I've been noticing in your article. One is a little bit more about the wonderful photographs of Mr. Pellegrin. According to the article, you've been working together for 20 years.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, in the preface, You talk about the role of the Western imperial powers in creating some of this chaos in the Middle East. So could you expand on that also, please?
Sure. Yeah, to your first question, yes, Paolo and I have been working together for just about 20 years at this point. And I think we've done about, I don't know, 11, 12 stories for the New York Times Magazine together. And it's a very intimate relationship because this was a unique project. It took us a year and a half, but even on our regular articles, we were traveling together for, say, 6 weeks at a time. So we're kind of like an old married couple at this point. To your second question about the carving up of the region, to really get at why I think this region is in such chaos is you really have to look at the way some of these countries were created at the end of World War One at the Paris Peace Conference. Essentially, Britain and France, as two of the victors of World War One, carved up the region between themselves as colonial spheres of influence. And it's not a coincidence that the countries that are really falling apart now, or that are fractured to the point where they will probably never be put back together, Syria, Iraq, Libya, are all of those countries that were, this is a small handful of countries that were artificially created by the colonial powers at the end of World War One. And so I think a huge contributing factor to why these countries have fractured is that they always had a very shallow sense of national allegiance. What people's real allegiance was to tribe or to their sectarian affiliation or their clan. And so when a revolution comes along, like you had in Libya, or like you're having now in Syria, without a sense of national allegiance and national identity, people revert back to their tribal or their sectarian affiliations. Very different, say, than to Egypt. Egypt has a nationalist identity going back, 3,000 years. So I don't think there was ever a fear that Egypt was going to fall apart in that way. But certainly that's what you're seeing in Libya and Egypt, Libya and Iraq and Syria.
Can you talk a little more, Scott? You see in the article that European powers adopted the same divide-and-conquer approach that served them so well in the colonization of sub-Saharan Africa. What did they do?
Well, it's a classic divide-and-conquer strategy where what the British and the French did was they would empower as their local overseers, and they did this throughout Africa, and they did it in the Middle East. They would turn to a local, to a minority tribe or minority ethnic group, to serve as their local overseers, knowing that that minority could never rebel against the colonial masters, because then the disenfranchised majority would rise up and cut their throats. Mm-hmm. So what you had in Iraq was, which was a majority Shia country, the British installed a Sunni king. What you had in Syria, which was a Sunni majority country, you had the French turn to the Alawites, which was the splinter group of the Shia. So what you created over time, and you look at Saddam Hussein, he was Sunni. All the leadership, virtually all the leadership around him was Sunni. You look at Syria today, virtually all the leaders around Bashar al-Assad are Alawite. Mm-hmm. So you create this you create this privileged minority that lords their power over the majority, and so it's a devilishly clever way for a foreign power to control a place. So with very few soldiers, very few civil servants, you can by creating this local minority tribe that you turn to, you can exert tremendous authority.
Thanks, Helen, so much for your call. Jake in Oshkosh, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, Kathleen. And you got me thinking about something. If the Israeli-Palestinian conflict could ever be resolved, could that be the beginning of putting the Arab nation back together again?
You know, that's a great question, and I've had an evolution in my own thinking on this. I mean, of course, it would be wonderful if the Arab-Israeli issue, the Palestinian-Israeli issue, could be resolved. I actually think now that things have so degenerated in the rest of the region that I don't know that it would have very much influence at all in, say, what's happening in Iraq or in Syria or in Libya or in Yemen, for that matter. I think that it's gone beyond that. And you also have to bear in mind that, and this was in, it kind of goes into what I was talking about at the beginning about the initial optimism I had about the Arab Spring, is that really for the first time you had ferment throughout the region that had very little, if anything, to do with Israel. It had very little, if anything, to do with the West. This was directed at their own leaders and the corruption and nepotism that had always typified these regimes. So, of course, it could have nothing but a positive effect if the Palestinians and the Israelis ever came to some sort of rapprochement. But I think at this point it would have a very limited impact.
Thanks so much for the call. You see some things here that just you read it and you think, oh my gosh, this is just going to go on forever. But this is a fairly dramatic statement. You highlight the stories of people from Egypt, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Tunisia, and Yemen, all republics rather than monarchies, you write. Of the six, you say, the three disintegrated so completely as to raise doubt they will ever again exist as functioning states, and they are Iraq, Syria, and Libya.
Right.
That's, oh my gosh, really?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. I have a limited, a glimmer of optimism about Iraq, actually, that maybe in the somewhat near future, since it seems the West is, and the United States is back engaged in a more positive way than they were one time, that maybe in Iraq you could come to some sort of accommodation between the three main communities in Iraq, the Sunni and the Shia and the Kurds. Very little optimism for Syria. I think Syria is going to burn for the next 15 years.
Oh.
And Libya, adding to the Balkanization that you see in Libya today, the crisis that's coming in Libya is it's going to run out of money next year. They've been burning through their hard currency reserves. which used at one point were $150 billion. It's now down to about $40 billion. And so you can just project this out. It's going to run out of money in probably about a year from now. And that's, and then you could be headed to something like what we've seen in Somalia. And so, yeah, I think that what you see in a number of places in the region are truly failed states that don't get ever put back together, kind of like Somalia has been. But Somalia is kind of tucked away. It's isolated. It's not at the center of the world's attention. It's going to be a much more dire situation if that's the case with Syria or Libya.
Hmm. Scott Anderson is our guest this hour. His story is the whole issue of the New York Times Sunday Magazine on August 14, Fractured Lands. More than a decade of war, terror, and revolution has left a trail of ruin in the Arab world. It's the story of how a region came apart, seen through the eyes of six people whose lives were changed forever. Scott has been covering this part of the world for a long time. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times, author of Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. Ed in West Allis, hi.
I think that the history of this region is so murky and so troubling. And we got into this folly in 2003 with no one in the Bush administration understanding the depth of the history of and just the utter chaos that existed in this region. And I want your guest to talk a little bit about T.E. Lawrence, this very murky figure around World War One and the end of World War One. President Kennedy said at one time that he thought The Seven Pillars of Wisdom was one of his favorite books. But I view Lawrence in a completely different light. And I think he created in that part of the world some of the conditions that we're facing in 2016.
Scott.
Right. Well, in fact, T.E. Lawrence was one of the main characters of my book, Lawrence in Arabia. I spent 5 years kind of researching him and writing about him, and along with a handful of other intelligence agents that were operating in the Middle East during World War One. Yes, Lawrence is a very enigmatic and controversial figure. But one thing that I have to say about Lawrence was he saw disaster coming if his own government, the British government, tried to exert their colonial will on the Arab world. And I mean, not to go too much into back history, but basically the British government had made these extravagant promises to the Arabs if they would rise up and revolt against the Ottomans being allied with Germany in World War One. At the same time that they had made these promises to the Arabs, and Lawrence being one of their main liaison officers to the Arabs, they went into a secret deal with the French to renege on those promises and to carve up the region between themselves. Lawrence, both from a sense of honor of what had been promised to the Arabs, but also from just a standpoint of political acumen, he knew that you could not colonize the Arab Muslim world if you were a Western Christian nation like Britain. So he tried mightily to forestall and to avert the colonization of the Arab world, and to the point where he was finally just kicked out of the Paris Peace Conference because he wouldn't stop talking about it. The fix went in his absence, and sure enough, within about a year, the entire Arab world under French and British control had gone up in flames. So I think actually Lawrence was one of the people who really was very prescient about seeing what was going to, the disaster that was coming if the West tried to control this part of the world.
Thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, T. Lawrence, that's a great segue into what I'm going to ask. Given the kind of, whatever one thinks of what he did, given his intimate knowledge of the area and seeing how we've had none of that in the past 15 years there, I'd like to ask Mr. Anderson, what do you think, assuming a win by Hillary Clinton in November, because the alternative is just too horrendous to think about, what are the first two or three things that a new President Clinton should do with regard to the Middle East to repair U.S. relations to the extent possible with the Arab world? Just wondering what you think about that.
Yeah. My advice would be two things. I think it's finally started now, belatedly under the Obama administration, of kind of forging an international coalition to work against ISIS. You're starting to see glimmers of a coalition building around ISIS because this is such a barbarous group. It's somewhat reminiscent of the coalition that George Bush Sr. created in going into Kuwait in 1991. I think the more we can restore ties with not just moderate Arab regimes, but even conservative Arab regimes, that's one. Number two, I think that, and I see very little chance of this happening, whoever is elected president, that to have a more even-handed policy towards Palestinian-Israeli relations. I mean, certainly throughout the Arab world, there is this view that, the Americans are completely in the pocket of the Israelis and that they're not honest brokers, towards, forging any kind of peace. And so I think that if any administration wanted to make a quick overture to the Arab world, it would be to take a firmer stand against some of the excesses of the Israeli government, whether it is involved with building new settlements in the West Bank.
And when you say restore ties with moderate Arab regimes, you're thinking of what regimes?
I'm afraid you're going to ask me that because a lot of the regimes have the moderate ones have gone by the wayside now. Certainly, the Gulf states, even though I wouldn't say they're necessarily moderate in their religious or their social standing, but these are countries that are going to be vitally important to us to if we ever hope to end the war in Syria. I also think we need to, and I think this is probably the subtext to the nuclear deal with Iran. I think there's been a belated recognition that we need to restore relations with Iran. That Iran, whether we like it or not, Iran is a major player throughout the region, and to try to isolate it, to keep it isolated, is not working for us. It hasn't worked for us, for 35 years now. So I think that is a really key thing too, to try to come to some sort of rapprochement with Iran.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Syria here for a moment, because I'm having a very hard time understanding, Scott, if there are groups who are effectively fighting Assad and ISIS that we should be supporting. Who are we supporting? Who might be doing a good job in fighting both Assad and ISIS? Is there such an entity or not?
Syria is has descended into such chaos. Are there good guys there? I don't know that there are. My main Syrian subject in the article is this young college student from City of Homs in Syria, and who talked with real disdain about the Free Syrian Army and called them just a bunch of gangsters. And of course, the Free Syrian Army are the very ones that were being touted by John McCain and others as the kind of heralds of democracy, that these were moderates who would usher in democracy if they came to power in Syria. The problem you have in Syria is that everything it's basically become like a gangland war. So the FSA of today, there may be wonderful Democrat moderates within FSA, but they also will go into accommodation with al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria, with ISIS. The battlefield is so vicious and so in such chaos that you see these patchworks of alliances and hidden deals going constantly. So, short answer, are there good guys in Syria? I'm sure there are, but I don't know how you'd ever identify who they are.
Hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Scott Anderson is our guest. He is the author of a very lengthy and important piece in the New York Times Magazine on August 14. It's the entire issue. He has spent a lot of time in the Middle East. This piece of journalism, he spent 16 months traveling and tells the story of what's going on in many of these Arab nations through the eyes and hopes and shattered hopes of six different characters from different countries, and it's a good way to tell the story. So the question is, you know, after the hopes of the Arab Spring, what happened? Our number is 800-486-8655. More phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next caller is Dag in Ashland. Hi, Dag.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I guess I got a couple of questions, comments here. One is what about the Alawi and what religion Assad's wife is.
What religion? Who is?
Assad's wife.
Assad's wife.
What her religion is? You know, I think she, I could be wrong on this, but I think she's actually Christian.
But, and the Alawi are also, according to the Syrian Observatory on Human Rights, have had fatalities at four times their representation of the population. You know, they have 10% population. They've had 40% of the casualties. But addressing this ethnic division thing and what's going on, but, you know, there's three investigative journalists, prize-winning investigative journalists, that have been giving a different narrative on the Syrian conflict. Robert Perry of the Iran-Contra fame, Seymour Hersh of the My Lai and Abu Ghraib, and now Stephen Kinzer of the Boston Globe has started addressing the issues, especially in Aleppo.
Scott, you want to respond?
Well, I mean, yes, right. I'm not sure. There's all kinds of different, you know, theories about Syria, but I'm not sure what exactly the question is.
What is the question, Dag?
The question is about the whole dominant narrative about Syria, and you know, Time magazine in 2012 had articles on Aleppo and outlining, you know, they were totally sympathetic to the rebels, but outlining that they are not welcome, that everybody hated them, and the rebels said, "Oh, these people in Aleppo, they're all traitors to the country, they're all supporters of the criminal Bashar."
Well, I mean, I think it kind of goes to what I was saying just a few minutes ago, that it's very hard to identify who the good guys are, if any, so-called good guys, if any, are in Syria. I mean, there's no denying the fact that the Alawites, and with an alliance with the Christian minority in Syria, which is about 5% of the population, have had a tremendous monopoly on the political and economic power of Syria for generations, and certainly, you know, if you look at why the reaction when the demonstration started against the Assad regime started in March of 2011, why in other countries was some accommodation given to the protesters? In Syria, there was absolutely none. The protesters were met with machine guns, and it was a fear by the Alawite and Christian minority who control the country that if any sort of accommodation would lead to their annihilation. They may well have been right, and certainly they would be right today, I think. I mean, if Assad goes, you're going to see a mass exodus of Alawites and Christians out of Syria. You're already starting to see a lot of Christians leave. But, you know, it just goes back to this thing. I don't know how you sort of identify who the good guys and the bad guys are in Syria, because I think it's all very fluid.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to have the hour, we'll go back to phone calls in a moment, but I don't want to have the hour go by without talking about the huge number of people who have left, the people who are dying in the Mediterranean, the refugee crisis. Oh, it is so sad, Scott, and we don't have a handle on that by any means.
No. I spent a week with Paolo, the photographer. We spent a week on a Doctors Without Borders boat in the Mediterranean off the Libyan coast. They rescued some 800 refugees coming across on these two grotesquely overloaded fishing boats. These people were probably a few hours away from dying if Doctors Without Borders hadn't found them. We also went to Greece, and we're seeing people coming across every night. One thing I'll say about the refugees, I know that it's become an issue in this country's presidential election campaign. It's a huge issue across Europe. But like refugees throughout history, the people who tend to leave, even a war zone like Syria, they always tend to be the most industrious and ambitious, and it's always the best and the brightest of a country. And I make the point in my article with Kulod al-Zaidi, the Iraqi woman who's now in Austria, that really, Austria's gain is Iraq's loss, because the people who are leaving these countries now are the very people who those countries need to, if these countries are ever going to mend.
Let's go to Al next in Milwaukee. Hi, Al.
Good afternoon. I'm sorry, my English is not all that good. I am Egyptian that have been living in the U.S. for about 28 years. I truly respect your guest and his sick people that he's talking about. However, we were a culture that existed a long time, way before the U.S., a religion that has been working for us in our countries. I truly believe if the West, especially the U.S., stops supporting the Israeli regime and just take their interest away from the Middle East, we can govern ourselves. We can find a way, even if we have to kill each other until one of us wins. If that's the worst case scenario, we can do it on our own. We really don't need nobody. And I really take issues with his playing God, saying the Middle East will go to pieces just because, that's not us. We know how to live. We know how to be good people, and we know how to deal with our own issues.
Do you think Syria will survive, Al?
There is absolutely nothing wrong with Syria except that it became the playground between the U.S. and Russia.
Scott.
Well, I respectfully disagree. I think there's huge issues with Syria that have nothing to do with either Russia or the United States. I agree with it to a certain point that if the West in particular, and certainly now with Russia, if they left the region alone, maybe things could sort out on their own. That didn't happen. And, what you had happen instead, and you can go back through history of the Western influence in the region, and certainly what happened in the Cold War was that you had one dictatorship after another line up either in the Soviet camp or in the American camp. And the Soviets and the Americans abetted these dictators to keep their people in thrall. I'm not trying to play God, but I have spent a lot of time in the region, and I just have to call it like I see it.
Mm-hmm. And it must have been so hard. I really admire. Well, you're a great writer, but you have to be brave to do stories like this, Scott, don't you? I mean, seriously.
Yes. I mean, I suppose. And it was one of the sad things about this region is this has gotten. As a foreigner, as a journalist, as a Western journalist, there's whole areas now that are just too deadly to try to operate in. And the sad thing is that Syria, for example, I write for the New York Times. The New York Times has a policy that they will not send any reporter in on the rebel side in Syria because it's of the kidnappings, the beheadings of journalists. You can go in on the government side if the government will let you in. But so the part of the tragedy of all this is that this slaughter can go on in relative silence,
right?
Because there's no outside observers who can report back on this stuff.
Yeah.
Now.
Well, that's what your piece is important. Scott, thank you very much for being with us. I feel like we just touched the surface. But
it was my pleasure, Kat.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yep.
Scott Anderson and his piece is in the New York Times from the Sunday magazine just a couple days ago, Fractured Lands. It's the result of, a lifetime of his interest in this part of the world, but very intensive 16 months of traveling, looking at Egypt, Libya, Syria, Iraq, and Kurdistan, but also Tunisia, and told through the eyes of six people whose lives have been forever changed by what's happened in their countries. So it's on our website, too, in case you don't get the Times Magazine. Thanks so much to KP Whaley for producing this very interesting hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for your contributions. We have news coming up, and we'll return, so stay with us.